Good morning and welcome to the Mr. Elvin Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Mottram. The morning after, the Redskins officially hired Ron Rivera to be their next head coach. The poor guy. Here to talk about that and all things Redskins is my good friend and a man so rich and so in touch with reality that he wishes people happy Thanksgiving on January 2nd. It's Matt Turrell. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Jamie. It's only a banana. I mean, what could it possibly cost?
It did remind me of that moment.
That was what I thought, totally.
So was that ever addressed? Like, so Dan Snyder comes after the press conference, kicks it off by, and the background here is he hadn't spoken publicly in months, kicks it off by telling everybody happy Thanksgiving. Was that just a faux pas, or was that some sort of sly reference to something?
The prevailing theory among like the national media and people who are predisposed to think that Dan Snyder's an abject moron is that Dan Snyder's an abject moron. But the prevailing theory amongst the people who are inclined to cut him some slack is that apparently the Redskins beat the Panthers at the game closest to Thanksgiving, which led to Rivera's firing, which led in turn to Rivera's hiring. And Snyder was attempting to reference that. It's unclear. If you watch the video of the presser, Rivera appears to laugh more at the line than literally anyone else in the world. So maybe there's something to that.
And the courtship apparently did begin right after that game and right after Rivera was fired, all the way back in like early December, I guess. I don't think it's cutting him any slack to say that that was his intended joke or reference, because that is such a bad joke, such a convoluted, like weird thing to say, that I think it's more generous to say, look, it's January 2nd. You're saying happy new year to all sorts of people in all sorts of contexts throughout your day. You're up there and maybe you're a little nervous and you say happy Thanksgiving. I think that's the more generous interpretation. If it was a joke, it's truly one of the worst jokes I've ever heard.
Well, I mean, if it's a joke, there's a real sort of a rich guy sense of humor, which without getting political on a sports podcast, I mean, we've all seen the president's tweets and are becoming familiar with this sort of like, haha, I just really belittled you and reminded you of something painful in your life. Isn't that funny? Kind of rich guy humor. And I'm willing to believe that Snyder indulges in that. That said, I also do know for reasonable certainty that Snyder is a really nervous public speaker, really doesn't like putting himself out there, probably because when he did put himself out there 20 years ago, he was justifiably scorched. But I'm willing to buy the charitable interpretation also. And, you know, maybe we should do that. I feel like there's a lot of slack cutting these days. Everybody seems really ready to be excited about the Redskins again. So maybe we should start with that and say, Dan, we know it wasn't a bad joke. We know you were just nervous and we forgive you.
Yeah. And either way, it goes into the like Dan Snyder / modern Redskins Hall of Shame, you know, right there with winning off the field. The culture is damn good. All that jazz about all that jazz, not being a Redskins quote, but you know what I mean? It was a great week. Dan Snyder still owns the team. The team is still called the Redskins. They still play in Rajon, Maryland. They still went 3-13. But it was a great week.
So you're fully on board. You're fired up and ready to go. Is that accurate?
I don't know, man. I mean, World War III was trending on Twitter last night. It's all relative, but yeah, like they fired Bruce Allen, which was no sure thing, and it was something we were calling for years. So let's just start there. Like that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. So I don't know if you saw, I had actually two city paper columns in the last 3 days or 4 days or whatever. One where my thesis was, yeah, great. They fired Bruce Allen, which is good. And they hired Ron Rivera, which looks good, but who cares? Because as I say so often, as long as Snyder owns the team, they're doomed to failure. And then
I cannot get down with that, but go on.
Well, so I got pretty roasted. Not pretty roast, that's a bit much, but there was a vocal contingent on Twitter that like took me to task over this, but enough of them framed it in a thoughtful aspect that I returned with, okay, let me rephrase this. Here's seven things I need to see to believe that things are different this time. Right. But I'm surprised to hear you so emphatically say you can't get down with that, because it was the exact same playbook as the, you know, Zorn Serato handover to Allen and Shanahan, right, like that to a T.
Right. It's not like I'm like recreating Shepard Fairey posters with, you know, Dan Snyder's face. I'm just saying, like, look, he's going to own the team for the next several decades. We just need to accept that.
Well, it, see, but I'm not, I don't mean when I say that, I don't mean it in like an abstract, like rawr, he's evil, he has a dark heart sense. I mean, I believe that concretely he is incapable as he's currently constituted, certainly as he was when I was acquainted, however, you know, remotely with him a decade ago. And I haven't seen much to believe that he's changed.
Right.
The way he's wired is he wants to be at least partially responsible for the success. So even if he makes the right moves, and he's done this again and again, yeah, where he'll make what initially appears to be the right move, once things go well, he has to interject himself somehow so he can be part of the success. So I believe there's a real, like, concrete reason that as long as he's there, they'll keep failing. It's not just like it's a curse or whatever, you know?
Right, right. And it does feel like we've seen this movie before, and it was awful. It was like The Mummy was the worst movie I think I've ever paid to see. And it was the Serato firing and the Shanahan hiring. You know, that's what this all reminds us of, and that went so terribly wrong. That said, like, for them to get rid of Allen and then actually get a competent head coach. And I'm not like, you know, I'm not saying it was a great hire, but on a curve, like, it was kind of great to end up with Ron Rivera. And I don't live in DC and I don't really interact with Redskins fans regularly. And everybody I talk to about this is like, why do Redskins people seem so fired up? Why they seem so fired up is like the last time we were doing this podcast, we were talking about, you know, if the Redskins fire Bruce Allen, and that they might make Bruce Callahan the permanent head coach. And look where we are now is like, we got rid of Allen and we got a head coach who, you know, he's good. He's average. He's like a credible, competent, experienced, track record, like successful, fiery, culture changing head coach. It just seems like we're in as good of a place as we could have possibly hoped for a couple weeks back.
Agreed. And if in the abstract you told me that, you know, if this were not the Redskins, but this has happened to a different team, you know, one of the other hapless teams, the Browns or whoever, and you sort of recounted with the analogous figures exactly what has happened, I would be like, oh yeah, they're in dramatically better shape now than they were before. The problem is, I don't see, while the handover from Allen reminds me of the Serato Zorn to Allen Shanahan, the actual sort of archetype of head coach that we've got here is almost 100% Marty Schottenheimer. It would be a little bit of Joe Gibbs if Joe Gibbs hadn't been coming back to Washington. If Gibbs had done the same thing, but in Carolina or something.
Right. Well, and won 3 Super Bowls. I mean, I don't want to pump Ron Rivera up too much.
No, but I mean, I feel like there's a similarity in that, like, Gibbs's strengths are, you know, he's sort of this overseer, this executive, this guy who builds the team, who knows the players, who gets buy-in, who is hard-nosed, but not like an asshole. Like, he seems to be that kind of archetype, and Schottenheimer is probably a closer comparison, and that's what scares me, because when Snyder brought in Schottenheimer, that was arguably the worst handled, you know, coach of his tenure, and sort of what set the template for everybody to think that Snyder's a moron.
I was going to say, but that was so early on, and I think Snyder had these, like, you know, is it illusions of grandeur or delusions of grandeur? It's illusions, right?
I think you could do either.
I just feel like it was a different time, man. Like, he was so fresh. He wasn't going to be content with, like, a competent head coach that was contending for division titles, maybe with, like, kind of a boring style of play. He wanted Steve Spurrier, man, or whatever, you know, like, and now after 20 years of failure, like, well, dude, like a 500 plus record, with no matter how you get it, sounds pretty good. But that would be putting faith in Snyder actually, you know, learning and improving.
Well, and it also, yes, agreed on that. And it also is a more charitable interpretation of the changeover from Marty to Spurrier, because there's another version that says it didn't matter how interesting or boring the next coach was, Snyder just wanted someone who would let him be more involved, when what we actually want is for him to be less involved in that. Although one of the things I argued in that follow-up column is that I liked hearing from Snyder, however briefly, yesterday. I think he needs to talk more. He shouldn't, you know, I think he took the lesson of like, oh my God, they think I meddle. I better not talk. And then they'll know I'm not participating in anything. And it just backfired catastrophically. And he needs to realize
that. Happy Thanksgiving thing didn't help.
No. Well, nothing helps. He's the only thing that would help is if he somehow was willing to get out there and sort of play himself up as a neurotic, awkward dude, you know, sort of do the Woody Allen, I don't know, the sort of self-deprecating Jewish shtick that, like, I've basically built my entire life on. Like, that might work for him rather than trying to get out there and be like, I'm tall and awesome, when he is clearly neither tall nor awesome.
Here's how far down we were. We hired, by all accounts, a guy who's like a pretty league average coach, head coach, and we still don't really have a GM or anybody running the football operation other than, I guess, that head coach and whoever was here before, Eric Schaefer, Kyle Smith, whatever. And yet we're still ecstatic, or I'm ecstatic.
I'm cautiously optimistic, which is about as ecstatic as I think this team can make me right
and
now.
And I'm trying to piece that together. Like, yeah. I mean, I think Rivera's a pretty likable guy. Maybe that's got a big part of it. You know, like, I didn't want to hire Urban Meyer in part because I think Urban Meyer's an asshole. Like, I think Ron Rivera is the opposite of that. So maybe that is what helps. I also think I'm kind of falling for the roster and the foundational pieces, which sounds so weird.
Yes.
Given that they just went 3-13, but it's true.
I'm 100% with you. I absolutely agree. The team on the field, I'm actually kind of excited about, and I wish they would announce the offensive coordinator at the time we're recording this. Spoiler alert, I guess, in case they do it in 10 minutes. We don't know yet who the offensive coordinator is going to be. And I feel like that would give me a little more enthusiasm overall, because I love the selection of Jack Del Rio's defensive coordinator. I think it's terrific. I think it's basically the same as the Rivera hire, but on the defense. And I think this defense is one that he can mold and really, like, could improve dramatically with simply, you know, good coaching instead of the whatever that clown show was they had in there last year.
Dramatically, you know, the Rivera Del Rio factor, plus you have the number two pick, which is probably going to be Chase Young, plus all those other, like, draft assets that you've spent on, you know, John Allen and Montez Sweat and Deron Payne. I'm probably forgetting some other, like, blue chip guys. Like, they should be good. They should go from a defense that over the last several years has been bottom third to a defense that's, like, I don't know, top third to, like, at least top half.
You would certainly think. I mean, I think if we set our sights at top half, we're being realistic, and I think it's an achievable goal. I'm starting to question, and this is probably something we'll want to table until, you know, March, but I'm starting to question if they really should pick Chase Young, especially with the switch to a 4-3. I think that if you look at it, there's a lot of potentially really good pass rushers, 4-3 pass rushers on the roster. And if you were to believe that Montez Sweat could live up to his sort of, you know, double second round pick, first round pick status, maybe you take the opportunity to trade back and pick up some more picks.
I think anybody, unless somebody's, like, totally about Chase Young, like, you know, you have to have him, he's a Hall of Famer. Like, I think anybody with this roster would say, I'd rather have, like, a couple lower first round picks or a first and 2 seconds or something. You know what I mean? Whatever your haul is for the number two overall, either way, that's a mega asset.
And it's a double mega asset because Haskins is good enough that I don't think you could justify picking anyone. I think even if Burrows slipped to two, I still don't think the Redskins need to pick him. So I think there's tremendous value in you know, saying, hey, you want to get the second quarterback on the board, assuming the Burrows goes first overall. You know, this is the pick you've got to come to, because you never know what's going to happen between one and three. So there's a, it should be a pick that can yield a really, really strong haul for the Redskins. So anyway, like I said, this
let's move to the offense though, because like I was in the impression that Kevin O'Connell is the guy, but I haven't like read up on how certain that is. And I've seen along the way this week, there's been reported like definite things like Eric Schaefer is definitely out. Not clear. Steve Wilks is definitely going to be the defensive coordinator. Didn't happen. So I don't want to say like Kevin O'Connell is definitely going to be the offensive coordinator, but it does seem that way, right?
So the report last night, I think it was, and I'm getting this entirely from Twitter, and this is the kind of Twitter where I didn't click through and watch the clip.
Why would
but
you?
I think Rivera was on, God only knows. I think Rivera was on one of the shows. Maybe it was a Larry Michael show, which would explain why I didn't click through. And essentially said, hey, we think we've identified the special teams guy. We haven't identified the offensive guy for sure yet.
Right,
and the way people seemed to be reading that was that O'Connor?
Wait a minute. Is it O'Connell or O'Connor?
I think it's O'Connell, isn't it? I think you said O'Connell, okay. But this was more in the moment.
I think it's O'Connell, but there's an NBA media personality named O'Connor, and they both go by.
That's exactly what it is.
And it's very confusing.
Yeah. That's I think you've nailed it. And I also used to confuse Kevin O'Connor with Kevin Clark, but which is another story entirely. But yeah, so the feeling people got wasn't that he was saying just we're still talking to people, but more it was like, yes, KOC didn't like, you know, blow his doors off or whatever.
Well, there's that. I don't know if I want KOC back or not. I mean, the offense sucked this year, but how much of that was his fault? How much of like, it does seem like the closer you are to the team, the more you like this guy. So he must have that like McVay factor. And I hate to make that comparison, but he must have that factor of like, he's an impressive dude, you know, just like in person, because the results aren't there.
But I do think there's a I don't know what to call it, a McVay rebound factor in Ashburn with this team, where they are terrified of losing the next McVay the way they lost the actual McVay. So I think there's a tendency to overinflate anybody who has anything resembling that McVay factor, which is why I'm glad Rivera is the one doing the evaluation, because he's coming in from the outside. He seems like, you know, a level-headed dude.
He's going to give KOC a good evaluation. As a fan, though, I mean, it's real, because three of the, I'm not going to say best coaches, but maybe most notable coaches across the league are McVay, Kyle Shanahan, Matt LaFleur. I might be missing somebody. There's been so many at this point.
Well, I mean,
they're all guys that were like,
you could certainly say
as offensive coordinators or offensive assistants this past decade.
Well, yeah. I mean, you could certainly say without doing best or whatever, that three out of the six NFC playoff teams, or however many it is, eight, whatever it is, I'm bad at math, but three of the NFC playoff teams are coached by ex-Redskins assistants.
Wait a minute, who are they?
The three you just listed.
Did the Rams make it? I thought the Rams did not make it.
Oh, no, you're right. The Rams.
Okay, I thought I was forgetting somebody.
So, no, you're absolutely right. Now, Arthur Smith is the one who I like to associate with the Redskins, but no one else does. He was there for 1 year as a qual control coach or whatever, but he's in the playoffs too, so I don't know.
I think of myself as a quality control man.
I think of you that way too, in many ways. Are you just so much quality product, you know? How could you know?
I do want to, on the, which before we move away from the offense, if we were going to move away from the offense, is I mean, now there's a couple of foundational pieces that are on that side of the ball. Like when we were talking about the Redskins offense this summer, it was like, we have no idea about Haskins, we have no idea about Geis, who gives it, what's a Terry McLaurin? But now it's like, well, McLaurin's like a franchise receiver. And I mean, after posting one of the best rookie wide receiver seasons of the past, I don't know, decade at least, I saw some list where like it was like 10 studs and Terry McLaurin who had posted like, the best rookie seasons for wideouts. And in this offense too. And then Geis, I don't know. I mean, you have to be concerned about the injuries, but he at least showed you some stuff. And I think Geis is an exciting young, you know, foundational piece on offense. Haskins, I did not watch most of the games this season. And since he started so poorly statistically, And then like we really weren't watching, like weren't even podcasting towards the very end of the season. I was just so down on him, you know, almost like borderline writing him off. But then I looked at the numbers the other day. And if you just look at like the six or seven games he started, he posted like an 85 rating, and it went from, you know, bad to decent to pretty good at the end. If you looked at just his last three games, I think the rating was like over 100. I'm not basing whatever his future on that upswing towards the end of a lost season, but it's enough to be interesting as to like what he might.
Yeah, no, I agree. And having watched, I guess more of him than you did, you could see it too. One of the things I sort of keep saying about him is that there doesn't seem to be like one definable characteristic. You can't say he's this or he's that. He's a runner or he's a strong arm guy. He's just sort of this weirdly solid quarterback in the body and with an attitude, sort of a swagger that makes you think that he's going to have some sort of distinctive on-field, you know, presence, which we haven't seen yet. But I'm much more excited to see him improve literally every game that he played, and look at least good to, you know, adequate to good by the end at a minimum. Then, for example, Daniel Jones, who came out, had that spectacular first game where you're like, oh, he showed what he can do. That's what he can be. You know, that's his ceiling. But then had this weirdly up and down season and ended on a really mediocre stretch. I'm more encouraged by Haskins
for 5 touchdowns in week 16.
Well, I mean, I don't consider anything against that defense to be significant in any way. But yes, before torching the Redskins. But yeah, I wound up much more encouraged by Haskins than I thought I was going to be. And I certainly would be happy to see them, you know, start with him next year. That said, if Rivera comes in, meets the guy, evaluates him, and decides he wants to Josh Rosen him, I would not argue. And right. Part of me thinks there is no better test of Rivera's supposed power than if he were to decide to do that.
And overall, I like that he has that power. I like that he took the job knowing that Haskins is, you know, the guy that's here right now and the guy who, you know, Snyder wanted to draft just within the past 12 months. Like, he knew that coming in. It wasn't like foisted upon him as maybe it was on Gruden. And I liked his comments at the press conference too, which is like, Haskins could be a franchise guy. He's not there yet. We're going to put a plan together to get him there. You know, we also have some veterans that we like. You know, it wasn't like he put it all in on Haskins, but he wasn't, you know, talking shit about him either.
Yeah. It's interesting because that was my initial reaction when he said it. Then as I was reading through Twitter, it felt like people who actually heard him say it, because I didn't hear that quote, I just read it, felt like it was a sort of challenged Haskins or I don't know if you want to say a shot at Haskins, but they seemed more negative about the comment than I initially read it as. So
it felt right. Like the right amount of like supporting him without puffing him up.
Speaking of him, we haven't touched on yet that you and your Breaking Tea folks immediately had a really remarkable t-shirt and sort of character for him up and ready to go as championed by Breaking Tea brand ambassador, Burgundy Blog. I liked it, man. When did you guys come up with Ron Burgundy?
That was a true collab because we were dicking around with a couple different things like, hey, you know, obviously the Riverboat Ron nickname is out there. It's been out there for years. But that felt a little more like a Carolina thing and also a little bit more like something he owns. Like he literally might have that trademarked. I can't remember. I think we looked that up. And then there's the whole thing with like the Ron skins, which looked better than it sounded. So we were toying around with that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Burgundy Plug just threw it out there. He's like, I've got it. Ron Burgundy. I was like, yes, immediately. Yes.
Yeah.
That is such a great nickname for him in this town. And one of our designers, I'm like really going far into this now. We were like, okay, so what's that going to look like? I don't really want like Ron Rivera's face on my shirt. And I also don't want it to just say Ron Burgundy, because that doesn't make a lot of sense. What's his like, what are some defining characteristics? And it's like, well, he always wears those bitchin' transition lenses. So one of our designers just drew like kind of a burgundy and gold colored transition lenses with the headset, and it just worked perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those ones where you nailed it. I'm not just saying this as like a weird quasi ad read in the middle of our conversation. I genuinely, when Burgundy Blog shared the T-shirt, I was like, oh man, that nailed it, and that is, I assume it's sold like crazy. Well, given this fan base,
it's weird, you know, because like I'm a Redskins fan, and I'm not like buying Redskins shit. I haven't been buying Redskins shit for several years now. And also, we like it came out on like Christmas, our New Year's Eve, on Thanksgiving Eve, which is a, you know, not a great time for the internet. So it kind of overcame those circumstances to perform really well. And yeah, that was a good one. The current debate is like, should we do a Happy Thanksgiving everybody shirt or not? And I've gone back and forth on this 20 times. It's tearing me apart. I think we're gonna do it.
See, it's interesting for a franchise that is has a questionable relationship with Native Americans at best, for two of the front office's major, I don't know if you want to call them gaffes or whatever, to involve Thanksgiving between this and the Harvest Feast, it sure feels like they should just find a way to market and own the Thanksgiving space, you know?
Well, Dan Snyder's very influential in the Thanksgiving space.
He really is. I mean, when I think influential in any space, I think Johnny Rockets, I think Six Flags, I mean, those are strong brands.
It's funny though. I mean, over the years we have done shirts for like Winning Off the Field and The Culture Is Damn Good and whatever. And like those always kind of sell because they also, it's like, they're not here today, gone tomorrow. They hold up. Like people will add those to cart like several years later, because like I was referencing, like there is this kind of hall of shame factor with like modern era Redskins ineptitude.
Yes, and I also think there's, now we're really in the weeds, but I think there's a certain self-selecting element in your client base, in that people who come to you for shirts probably like not putting money directly in Dan Snyder's pockets.
Yeah.
So they are going to be even more inclined to buy the sort of self-loathing, sarcastic shirts when it comes to that team.
Yeah, it's also like the portion of the fan base that's like in the know.
Yeah.
And like they kind of, it's a signal to other people, like if you wear a shirt that says like Happy Thanksgiving everybody, that's burgundy gold, it really at any time, but especially anytime soon, like it's going to be a conversation starter, or at least like something where people are like, cool shirt, you know, that sort of thing, versus like just the nice, like, you know, vintagey Redskins logo tee.
Yes, although I did have to explain my 19-31 national shirt several times over the holiday season. So I guess as you get farther away from the moment, there's more talking needed to be done. Anyway, what were we talking about with the team before I detoured us onto T-shirts?
I don't know. I mean, I kind of exhausted myself.
Well, let's then do just a quick round of, you know, whatever gimmicky name you want to call it. Like, what do you think the best case scenario is for next year, and how likely do you think they are to hit that best case?
I think best case scenario for next year is like 500 record, defense is top half in the league to top third. Haskins shows that like this is a guy you could build around.
I mean,
that's not best case. Best case is they can win 11 games or whatever and like make the playoffs. Like that could happen for any team, I think, any year.
Well, it's, I mean, very, it hasn't happened very, for the Redskins in however long.
Right. They have not won 11 games in 28 years, but a lot of teams do.
Well, and but I think that's crucial. I think I agree with you. I think best case for this team mm-hmm. is probably about 11 wins, mm-hmm. which would be historic for them.
Yeah.
So again, I guess then the question is, obviously there's still the draft and free agency to come, and we don't even know who the coaching staff is, but just purely based on these moves alone, I mean, what chance do you think there is that they make that significant of an improvement?
Honestly, at this point, I'm feeling enthusiastic, optimistic, and kind of expecting them to be like flirting with 500 next year. And, you know, it's weird because it's like I was celebrating 500 with Jay Gruden, and I feel like I would celebrate it again after Jay Gruden, because of the way that ended and how dire things were in just recent days. That, yeah, I think that's kind of like what I'm sort of expecting but also sort of what I'm hoping for.
Okay. I'll buy that. I think I'm hoping for better than that. But yeah, I think I'm expecting about 500. I think it's really going to depend how they get there. I mean, we used the Schottenheimer comparison before, and if I remember correctly, they went what, like 0-5 before finishing 8-8 or something like that.
Right.
It was something really extreme. 8-3
down the stretch.
Yeah. Something like that, I think, would be interesting. In some ways, it's what I want to see because it will do a great job of testing Snyder's commitment and patience to this overhaul. And certainly the flip side of starting out like Jim Zorn 6-2 and then cratering to 8-8 down the stretch. Also, I don't think that leaves us in a good place at the end of next year. So if it's going to be a 500 team, I think you have to be hoping for either a slow start or really just a steady growing year somehow. I don't know.
It would be weird to go the Zorn route. I mean, also Joe Gibbs' first year, I think, was very similar to Schottenheimer's year, where it was like a very slow start and then came on strong and foretold, you know, much greater success. I honestly, though, however you get there, if they're 500 next year with Haskins, who would be in his first full season, I mean, he played basically a half season this year.
Yeah.
A half season for a dreadful team. If they can go 8-8 with him at quarterback, and, you know, lots of kind of good young players across the roster, yeah, sign me up for that.
All right. I'm on board.
I shouldn't have said 11 wins. I should have said 10, because it really is delusional to, when you're, you know, caught up in like Redskins hysteria to project the best season since 1991.
Well, on the other hand, when your best season since 1991 is still a 5-loss season, which would be seen as devastating in some successful cities, I don't think it's that unreasonable. You didn't say 14 wins or 16 wins or whatever. I think an 11-win ceiling for next year is a reasonable place to set your highest expectations. I think that's okay.
I saw a graphic recently. The Redskins have now been on such a long run of failure that I think there's only 3 teams. Like, they're one of the top 3 teams in terms of conference championship game droughts. They're on year 27 or 28. And I think the Browns were the other team, and there was one more. Maybe the Lions? It was 3 teams that were up in like the high 20s, and I knew the Redskins had been bad for a long time, but I didn't know they were like in that select company.
Well, what's interesting is I think it was masked before because it used to be lumped in with the Washington D.C. teams as a city of, you know, playoff struggle or championship struggle. But the fact that the Nationals and the Capitals and the Mystics and whoever else I'm forgetting, the Valor, whoever else, have won championships in the last like 2 years. Suddenly the Wizards and the Redskins pop a lot more because you can't cite those hockey or baseball statistics to muddy it.
Yeah. Did you see the weird ass move the Nationals made last night? They signed Will Harris, the reliever.
Yeah, I did see it. I don't know enough about baseball to know how to feel about it. It certainly struck me as odd. How did you feel?
It's just super funky because he's one of the best relievers of the past 5 years. So, you know, curveball specialist, was in Houston, super effective reliever. Like, just based on that alone, you would say, oh, I'm fired up to have that dude for 3 years, $24 million. But he gave up some crucial homers in the postseason, including the home run to Howie Kendrick that clanged off the foul pole in game 7. Right. So that alone is weird, like, to sign that guy that you just, like, won the World Series off of. But then it's also at the expense of re-signing Daniel Hudson, who's probably now going to be let go. I don't know. Maybe they figured out a way to keep him, too. Daniel Hudson, not as successful over the last 5 years as Will Harris by any means, but was pretty successful for the Nats down the stretch and won Game 7 and threw the glove and all that. So they're bringing in the guy who gave up the home run and getting rid of the guy who won the championship. It's just a very interesting, kinky move.
It's bizarre. I will say, for Harris's sake, I think psychologically it is literally the best thing that could have happened to him, because I think it would be really easy to live with that home run and let it define you forever. And when the team that you gave it up to says, hey, we want you, oh, we're going to bring you in the very next season, yeah. I think that could go a long way towards making sure that he stays as the quality pitcher that he's been. But yeah, man, it was baffling because I don't know him that well. And the best thing I knew him from was giving up that home run. So it was strange.
He's a pretty anonymous guy. To like, for his numbers are fantastic, but you know, it's not like he's like Aroldis Chapman or somebody who like everybody knows.
Do you think they give him a World Series like ring when he gets here?
I know. Yeah, like on opening day when there's like the ceremonial stuff. Like, what does Will Harris get a special? Does he get a crown? Like, what is?
I mean, they're gonna show the highlights on the big screen at opening day.
So painful.
It's gonna be super awkward. Wow. Yeah. That was interesting. And the way the news came out, I don't know if they announced it or it just leaked, but it certainly had a little bit of a news dumpy feel to me.
Right. Yeah. It was like late on a Thursday night, still kind of a weird like holiday ish. Yeah. Time. Thanksgiving Day. Very strange.
All right. We've gone longer on the Redskins than we have lately, which is nice. And we even talked Nationals. Should we do a quick Mandalorian check-in?
Yeah, I mean, I watched the final episode last night, and I will just simply say I really enjoyed the first season, and I'm excited they've already announced it's coming back next fall. I can't wait to go on this Mando ride through the galaxy for the next, 100 episodes.
Agreed. I thought the last three episodes were some of the strongest of the season. I don't think we talk about any of the last three? I don't remember.
And by the way, spoilers, if you're not watching Mandalorian,
I mean, I don't know how much we'll wind up getting into it. Although, so did it lead you to do, because I love the image of you doing nerdy deep dives into like Star Wars lore, did the final scene lead you to do any research or Googling or anything?
No, not yet, but I will. Basically, my cadence is like, I will watch the episode and then I will listen to binge mode at some point before watching the next episode. So I haven't gotten to the binge mode part of the process yet.
Yeah, we over in the nerd side of culture, I think, need to really be considering building.
Was it when he got out of the crashed fighter?
Yeah,
thing.
So I'll let Jason Concepcion of Binge Mode give it to you in more detail because he's better at it than I am, and we really need as a nerd culture to really build him a statue or something for explaining this to people like you. Uh-huh. But suffice it to say that is a lightsaber called the Darksaber that has like a long history both theoretically in the world but also appeared periodically throughout the cartoons. And so the fact that he has it is significant in that the last people, yeah, so whatever. So if I say the idea of Jamie Mottram sitting around reading about the Darksaber is just amazing to me.
First of all, when he whipped that thing out, I was like, okay. And when you even said the last scene, like the significance of it, I was struggling to think of like what you were even referring to. Like that's how little I cared about his little light up sword.
Right.
But the fact that it's the Darksaber with all this lore, weighted behind it, it's terrific.
Wait until you listen to this week's Binge Mode, because that's what he does in whatever the section is called, where he does the deep dive.
Yeah.
And my goodness, is it a detailed deep dive? Because I didn't know a lot about it either. In fact, when it ended, my son, who is 9, was like, "That's the Darksaber," and I was like, I don't think so. And he's like, "No, it is." And I was like, "Oh, okay."
So when they talk about like hashtag canon, not canon, or whatever, mm-hmm. when they're talking about not canon, is that because they're talking about like the animated TV show?
No, so the animated version? TV shows are canon. What they're referring to is that when Disney, I don't know, if it was when they bought the properties or when they announced the Disney wiped out all of the what was called the extended universe, all the stuff in the novels and the old comics and the old stuff that was approved before Lucas sold it and was considered. I mean, there's hundreds of years of history, both in all directions, thousands of years of history backwards that they told comic book stories about, and Luke Skywalker had a wife, and I believe they had a kid, and Han and Leia had twins, not Kylo. Like, there was a whole different sort of sequence of events after Return of the Jedi, and when Disney took over, they're like, well, we want to make sequel movies, and we don't just want to adapt the stuff that's already there, so we're wiping out all of this existed extended universe canon. So that's what they're talking about, when they say Legends, hashtag not canon, that's what they're referring to. Disney rebranded it so they could still sell those stories, but they now slap a banner on it that says Legends to differentiate it from what is obviously true and historical, such as the films or the cartoons. So no, this is in the current Disney era cartoons. This thing appears a whole bunch.
Okay.
Like I keep saying, it's fascinating to me because it's a perfect illustration of why that, you know, everybody's like, oh, this is an Easter egg. That's an Easter egg. The other thing, this is a perfect Easter egg, because to my son, it was like amazing. To me, I was like, oh yeah, I've heard you talk about that. And to you, you were like, that's a cool sword, man. Like, you know, whatever, who cares? That's perfect. It's perfect.
Well, I feel like I'm in, socially, I'm like a Mandalorian brand ambassador, because everyone I talk to, I'm constantly like, look, guys, I don't even know what the new Star Wars film is called. I haven't seen like three of the last four movies that came out, like Solo or Rogue One. I've not seen a minute of them, but I love The Mandalorian. Like, you know, so like, yeah. I don't know shit about the galaxy or the canon, not canon or whatever. I just really like this like cool sci-fi Western, you know, serial TV show that I'm watching.
Yeah, what's interesting, and I know you haven't seen Rise of Skywalker, which is what the new Star Wars is called, and I don't know if you've followed any of the conversation around or anything, but like all recent Star Wars movies, it's been divisive, and like I didn't like it at all. I was really disappointed in it. I'm not going to go into any details. I will spare you mercifully all of that, but it's fascinating how just firmly they hit Mandalorian out of the park. And like, I don't want to sound like some sort of weird brand bot, but it really is like a quadrant, you know, whatever hit. Like my wife, who loves Star Wars, but you know, doesn't always follow the TV side of it or, you know, go that deeply. She likes the movies, but like, she's super into, she baked Baby Yoda cookies over the holidays, and like all of her friends like it. It's been a really impressive and fascinating success, which Disney desperately needed in light of the just sort of toxic scum that has sort of floated to the top of the movie.
It's impressive with Mandalorian, because like whatever the last movie, like the last movie in the trilogy, the second one of the most recent trilogy, with Adam Driver,
Last Jedi,
and whoever, and Mark Hamill was in it a lot. Like my plan was I was going to watch that on Netflix or Disney Plus or whatever, and then I'd be ready for the new one when it came out. And I made it through like 45 minutes of that other one, the last one. And
Last Jedi.
I mean, yeah. It was doing nothing for me. Like, I was super bored. Like, what is there a game on? You know, I was like looking at Twitter. Like, I just couldn't, it just did nothing. And Mandalorian's the exact opposite.
Yeah. Mandalorian was like, this week was great because it starts off with this, you know, super cool robot riding a motorcycle and shooting people. Like, where are you going to go wrong?
All the way in. Real quick on culture roundup is finished season three of Mrs. Maisel, which my wife and I both adore. It's just super fun show. Would recommend that to anyone, especially anyone who's looking for something to watch with their companion. The fabulous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon. Excellent. But now I don't know where to go from here. We have no Mandalorian, no Maisel.
Yeah, I mean, Disney Plus is really going to have to come up with something else pretty quickly to justify that $7 a month or whatever it is. I need recommendations on, and what there should be a recommendation site for, is I need recommendations of something that I can watch, not so much with my kids, but like on a plane, somewhere where other people will be able to see my screen, but, you know, still something that I will enjoy.
Have you ever watched Star Wars pornography?
No, actually, I have not. Do you know where I can find some?
I mean, I just next time you're on a plane, just Google.
Just Google Deviant Art Star Wars and we'll be good to go.
I mean, it must exist, right? I remember at some point, like I was totally into at some point. What was Avatar? Avatar porn. There was like blue people pornography.
Yes, yeah. With tails. Yeah. Well, what is it? Is it Rule 38 that if it exists, someone has made pornography of it? It's one of the rules of the internet. I don't remember which number it is.
I would expect to be higher than
so. Yeah, you would have thought it was rule one or two, but hey, who knows? Anything else? Your year-end music list, I think we discussed. Any podcasts you're listening to? I found an interesting podcast the other day. Anything else interesting you're listening to?
I had fallen out of, I think like I just forgot to subscribe to Song Exploder when I moved over to Spotify for my podcast listening habits. And I re-engaged with Song Exploder the other day, and there's just like a treasure trove of episodes where they broke down like specific songs with artists that I love, you know? So like just from this year alone, they broke down songs from like Bon Iver, Sharon Van Etten, Vampire Weekend, that were like some of my favorite songs of the year. And it's so cool the way they do it and spend like 25 minutes, like the Vampire Weekend song Harmony Hall, which is great. And I thought it was totally about Donald Trump and that administration. The episode starts with the lead singer of Vampire Weekend playing a voice memo from 2011 of him walking down the street in Manhattan and just like humming the barest bones of the song Harmony Hall that became one of my favorite songs of 2019. And I don't know, it just was awesome. If you like any of the artists that are featured, and they've had like Jeff Tweedy from Wilco and mostly like indie rock, you know, leaning artists, it's highest recommendation. Awesome podcast.
Yeah, Song Exploder, when it's either an artist you like, a song you like, or somebody who manages to make it interesting, it is among the best podcasts out there. Did you listen to the, I think it was a Fleetwood Mac song. Was it Go Your Own Way?
No, I haven't gotten to it yet.
It's pretty funny because I'm not entirely, I think they're talking to Lindsey Buckingham, if I remember correctly. Whoever it is they're talking to, I'm not entirely convinced that he understands what a podcast is,
what he's doing, yeah.
Like what he's doing. But the anecdotes are great. It's a really good episode, highly recommended. The one that I listened to that I liked, it's nowhere near the level of Song Explorer, it's not even close, but it was called it is music related, so I'll talk about it. It's called Deprogrammed, and it's basically a dude, you're going to be astounded to hear that he sounds like a white dude in his early 40s, probably with a beard, who gets some of his friends on the phone with him. They also, you'll be shocked to hear, mostly sound like white dudes in their early 40s with beards. Maybe mid-30s. Sorry, Deprogrammed guys, if you're younger than me. But basically, they try to put together a playlist for an artist. So he brings together a group of friends who like that artist, and whether he knows the band or not, and they listen to a certain amount of the band's catalog and then try to build a 10-song playlist. So each person picks 20 songs. They sort of compare their lists. Anything that all three of them have makes the list, and then they sort of debate whatever's left over, and then you can obviously go to the guy's Spotify account and listen to the playlist. And I started with a band that I like just to get a sense of how they would do, and it's weird because I can't imagine the podcast itself is any good if you don't know the band, but it is a good way to find playlists that's like, oh, everybody's always talked about, like, I don't know, Bad Religion or whatever, and I never had a way in. It's a really good sort of way in to artists. Now, they lean heavily towards the, I don't know, emo, pop punk, white guys with guitars, but like less jangly than the ones you usually like. I don't know. It was an interesting concept, reasonably well executed. And once I realized that the playlists were out there, which they didn't publicize nearly enough on the episodes I listened to, it was a worthwhile, you know, way to spend whatever, 20 minutes or whatever.
Was there actually a Bad Religion episode?
There was. It was a few weeks ago. The one I listened to was the Rentals episode, and they basically won my heart because the host had never listened to the Rentals and didn't even know who they were at first. I don't know if you remember the Rentals at all, but
vague.
So the Rentals are the project of Matt Sharp, who was the original bassist in Weezer for the first two albums that Weezer did.
Big bald guy?
Yeah, kind of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're great. I mean, he's continued to put out music. It's the band that Maya Rudolph was in, weirdly enough. And whatever. They've continued putting out music, and I love them. I love them dearly. I think Return of the Rentals is actually better than any of the Weezer albums, which was their first album. Anyway, point is, he was so fired up and excited to discover the Rentals that, like, he kind of won my heart there. I don't know that, you know, I don't know how much I would have liked it if he had been like, yeah, whatever. But it's nice. I like hearing people like things, you know, it's fun.
I'll start with the Bad Religion thing. I actually have a Bad Religion sweatshirt from some point in the early 90s that I still have. But I don't think I've listened to Bad Religion since the early 90s.
Well, you are the true 21st century digital boy, Jamie.
Oh, good poll. All right. Well, I don't know where, I mean, they had a song called American Jesus. I'm not sure where they did that.
Sorrow. They had a song called Sorrow. That could be a Redskins anthem.
Yeah. Ron Rivera could be the AJ.
Sure. Why not?
Anything else? We should stop.
Yeah, we're done. We've clearly petered out.
Is there any reason to come together again? What's our next excuse to podcast?
I don't know. I guess if they make a dramatic hire, but barring that, we're probably done until sort of the pre-draft run-up, right?
You know, we didn't even mention the fact that, like, while things are going so swimmingly for the Redskins since the season ended, like, let's put it in perspective. The Cowboys, meanwhile, took, like, most of a week to fire Jason Garrett. Had to have 3 meetings with him. And still don't have a coach, of course. The Giants have also fired their head coach. And I don't think they have a coach unless they hired one that just didn't move the needle at all.
No, Ron Rivera is the second longest tenured NFC East coach at the moment.
Yeah, my point is that these are the teams we get to play a combined, you know, 4 times next year. And they too, are a mess.
Well, let me ask you this.
Division, you know, the worst division in the league, but yeah, 2 of the 3 teams are kind of, you know, out to sea.
Let me ask you this. I do think you'll have an opinion on this as someone who is, you know, in a variety of businesses over the years, who has led businesses, who has hired, who has fired, who has, you know, built out corporate visions and whatnot, but also, you know, the world of sports. What could they have been talking about in 3 meetings? What was Jerry doing?
Like, so weird. And not just like, you know, my experience in business, where we have a Cowboys like media partner that we work with on, you know, merchandise. And I was like, are you angry about Garrett, you know, possibly coming back? Are you excited about a specific person that they might go after? And their response is basically like, we just don't know what the fuck is going on. Like, why would you need to have 3 meetings with the guy who's been there a decade or two?
If it were here, I would have thought they were trying to sort of float a trial balloon, like have a couple of meetings, right? See how the public sentiment turned.
Oh, the Bruce Allen's not being fired, he's just being reassigned trial balloon.
Yep. Yeah. Yep, exactly. But that really didn't seem to be what they were doing. They genuinely seemed to be like, it felt like, I don't know if you've ever had a breakup where, you know, you like each other, but the thing is just off the rails, and you know you need to break up. So you sort of sit around and have the same conversation over and over and over again.
Right.
And that's kind of what I pictured this being like.
Well, also credit to Snyder. That's a good comparison, by the way, but credit to Snyder for being so decisive and like starting the process back in early December and getting it done, like basically the day after the season ended, versus like, look at the Panthers. They fired Rivera a month ago and they still don't have a coach. Look at the Cowboys. Yes. Look at the Giants. Like, and it's a competitive market. All these teams that are now like, you know, the Browns, et cetera, that are looking for head coaches, they're now all jockeying against one another. The Redskins got, arguably for the Redskins specifically, like the best candidate out there. And they got him first. And now they don't have to compete with everybody else.
Agree. Now, it helps that what the Redskins really needed was a head coach with head coaching experience. And the best way to get that was to find a recently fired, well-regarded, respected head coach. Right. And you don't have to wait. Like, the Panthers are probably have been waiting to interview guys that they couldn't interview until this week, you know, and are looking at things like that.
Right. Or like, yeah. Eric Bieniemy, who, yeah, you know, his team is still in the playoffs and will be in the playoffs for another week and a half minimum.
Yep.
You know, no. So say you're locked in on him, but you can't get him presently, or you can't get his full attention presently. Like, you might be left holding the bag at the end of January.
Yep. Nope. Agreed. 100%. And yeah, let's end on that. That is a good note to give Snyder credit for.
Way to go, man.
We're so positive.
We're still doing the shirt.
Okay. Go do it.
All right. Cheers, man. Talk to you soon.
Take care. Bye.